cropping, which is a cosmetic procedure, and should never, of course, be performed at home, and we don't really endorse it.
Speed says Molly's next stop will be a temporary foster home while a search is launched for a permanent caretaker. She says the dog is still a happy and friendly puppy despite her ordeal. Mount Pleasant police have been notified, and anyone with information about the case is urged to contact them. Sports in the NBA. The Bulls beat the Magic 112-94 for their seventh straight win. Unless there be any doubt, the Packers are going back to back up Brett Hundley for the rest of the season. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Clouds today, a high of 37. Some drizzle this afternoon. Drizzle and snow later this afternoon and tonight, a low around 32. Tomorrow, more drizzle, freezing drizzle during the morning hours, a high of 36. Expanded forecast dry on Saturday for those last-minute shopping trips, a high of 29. Then for Sunday, Christmas Eve, a 40% chance of snow, mainly during the afternoon hours. Cooler on Christmas Eve, a high of just 24. For Christmas, partly sunny. Temperature slides even further, expecting a high on Christmas Day of just 18. Right now, we've got clouds and 35, winds out of the east-southeast at 9 miles an hour. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient eating and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Well, for those of us who love sugar and probably consume way too much of it, the next few minutes are going to be very important and perhaps a little bit dispiriting as well. We're going to be talking about an important new book that's just been published called The Case Against Sugar. It's written by Gary Taubes, a former staff writer for Discover magazine, a correspondent for the journal Science. His writing has appeared all over the place, and he is also the author of a previous book called Why We Get Fat and another book called Good Calories, Bad Calories. In this book called The Case Against Sugar, we learn what sugar is, how it acts in the body, and the really serious problems that it can create. And Gary Taubes also gives us kind of the historical long view in terms of how our consumption of sugar here in America has skyrocketed, and with it have skyrocketed the statistics in terms of diabetes in this country. I mean, it is an epidemic not discussed nearly as often as, for instance, the epidemic of obesity, which, of course, is also very much related to our consumption of sugar. And so this is an important book and an important topic. The book, by the way, is published by Anchor Books, which is a division of Penguin Random House. The title again, The Case Against Sugar. And Gary Taubes, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thanks for having me.
I'm intrigued that right at the front of the book, you quote a writer in the New York Times saying, "We are beyond question the greatest sugar consumers in the world, and many of our diseases may be attributed to too free a use of sweet food." And then we see the date of this excerpt, May 22nd,
1857. So somebody back in the mid-19th century knew that there might be a problem between sugar consumption and our own health. But of course, they had no way of knowing just how our use of sugar would escalate. Let's begin there. Describe to our listeners just what kind of escalation we are talking about and how and why that has occurred.
Well, this is what was fascinating doing the research for this book is, we're just now getting around to saying maybe sugar's bad for us. Maybe it actually causes heart disease and diabetes and obesity. But this has been an issue that's gone back 200 years to the end of the Industrial Revolution kicked up in the 19th century in the U.S. and around the world. It got cheaper and cheaper to refine and produce sugar. And the sugar industry, the ways we consume sugar today, chocolate bars, candy bars, ice cream, those industries all started in the 1840s, and then the soda soft drink industry kicked up in the 1870s, 1880s, with first Dr. Pepper and then Coca-Cola and PepsiCo. And so you saw the explosion, a 15-fold increase in sugar consumption over the course of the 19th century, and simultaneously, hospital records start recording this increase in diabetes. So it's a well-recognized disease. It's been recognized for a couple thousand years, but the hospital records go from seeing zero cases in a single year for the major hospitals in Boston and Philadelphia to one or two cases. By the 1870s, 1880s, you start getting three or four cases, and then 10 and 20, and you just see this curve shoot up. Till today, the estimate is one in 11 Americans is diabetic, whereas in a hospital in, say, 1900, say Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, that number would have been one in 300 patients in the hospital were diabetic. So the massive increases, they coincide completely with this massive increase in sugar consumption. And you have authorities throughout this period, and this erupts in the 1920s when people start first talking about diabetes as an epidemic. You have authorities saying sugar is clearly the prime suspect. Doesn't mean we're right, but before anything else, we would blame this diabetes on sugar consumption.
How is it that concern about sugar has not taken hold, or at least not consistently? What has kept us from understanding the role of sugar in issues like diabetes?
Well, there are two things. One is the role of the sugar industry, and the other is just the very tragically bad science in the nutrition and chronic disease research. The assumption always was, so type 2 diabetes is the common form of diabetes. It's about 90-95% of all cases. And that associates with obesity. So the idea was obesity causes it. As you get fatter, you're much more likely to become diabetic. So the idea was getting fatter causes it, and we get fat because we eat too much. And then in the 1960s, we got this idea that dietary fat, the saturated fat in our diets, causes heart disease. So the researchers locked on to this hypothesis. That's what it was an assumption, an idea that they'd never really tested. And they started doing these tests, and as other researchers started saying, wait, it's not dietary fat, it's sugar, there was a competition between them, and the fat guys won out. They won out not because the studies actually confirmed their hypothesis, but because they were more politically well-corrected, they got more funding, the press bought into their story better than it was always easy to assume that people who said you shouldn't eat sweets were kind of quackish health nuts. So by the 1970s, 1980s, just as we really should be understanding the physiological effects of sugar consumption, instead, our public health community is completely locked in on this idea that it's dietary fat and saturated fat that we shouldn't eat. And then by the 1980s, we're telling everyone we should eat low-fat diets and you should drink low-fat dairy. And when you take the fat out of a product, what you're left with is a pretty insipid, tasteless product. So the industry would deal with this is by replacing the fat with sugar. So by the 1980s, just when we're really clear that we have an obesity epidemic going on, or it should be, obesity rates are beginning to go up, we're telling people people are consuming more and more sugar than ever. And the sugar industry takes advantage of that throughout just by saying, hey, these quacks think sugar is bad for us, but the nutritionists, the authorities at Harvard and the University of Minnesota and Tufts University, they say it's fat and sugar is benign, and we buy into that completely until this century when the obesity and diabetes epidemics get so bad that finally people start saying, wait, there has to be something else going on here.
Right. And, of course, one thing that's important to say is that it isn't just that we consume sugar when we eat a candy bar or when we eat a chocolate frosted donut or whatever it might be that is very directly laden with sugar. I mean, and we know we're consuming sugar when we consume something like that. But that sugar is with us in all kinds of other things, in a sense, in a little more hidden fashion. Explain what's probably are the most serious cases of that in terms of what the typical American eats.
Well, sugar is one reason it took over the world, in essence, not just that we happen to, it does something to our brains and our bodies that we experience as intense pleasure, but it's also an extremely useful in cooking in many different ways and in creating the mouth feel and the texture of a substance and as a preservative. So it does end up in virtually every packaged processed food in our food supply. You could go through the supermarket and I think something like 60 or 70% of the products in there consume sugar, and the ones that don't are the ones it contains sugar, and the ones that don't are the ones that are on the external aisles, which are basically the fruits and vegetables and the meats and fish and fowl and the dairy products that aren't low-fat, sugar-filled yogurts. So it's virtually unavoidable, but the major sources of sugar in our diets are still, the sugary beverages, which include fruit juices. Even if there's no sugar added, if it's sweet and it's in liquid form, it's either, sugar or an artificial sweetener that's sweetening it. So those are still the major sources of sweeteners, and then breakfast cereals and the candy bars and all the rest, the pastries. And as this process through the 20th century, as we consume more and more sugar and our cravings for sugar got greater and greater, clearly the food industry thought we have to just, everything has to be a little sweet because Americans' tastes are sweet. And the Europeans, you could find these, throughout the record, going even into the 19th century, sort of coming to America and saying, my God, all your food is so sweet. How can you deal with it?
Interesting. By the way, offer a word of clarification here. When we're talking about sugar and the ways in which sugar can be really, really bad for us, are artificial sweeteners just as bad or similarly bad or not quite as bad or even worse? And does it vary from sweetener to sweetener?
And this is one of the questions that I don't think can be answered. I clearly don't think they're as bad as sugar itself, because the argument I'm making in this book is that sugar is the sugar consumption is the sort of primary trigger of obesity and diabetes epidemics. So one of the observations that we're trying to explain, the crime and effect that's been committed, and we're trying to find, the culprit, is obesity and diabetes epidemics that occur worldwide. Anywhere in the world, when a population transitions from eating whatever their original, their native diet was to eating a Western diet. So there's something about the Western diet and lifestyle that triggers obesity and diabetes. And you could find, and I talk about this in the book, you could find examples of obesity and diabetes epidemics 70, 80, 100 years ago, well before artificial sweeteners came along, and in populations that clearly weren't consuming artificial sweeteners. And so in that sense, sugar and the high fructose corn syrup, which is another version of sugar that didn't come along until the 1970s, is the prime suspect for causing obesity and diabetes. And when the artificial sweeteners, which begin to show up also in the 1880s, 1890s, used for particularly for diabetics who are being told by their doctors not to consume sugar, these are 300, 500 times as sweet as sugar. So the question you're asking is, if I'm consuming 100 pounds of sugar per year, and instead of that I'm going to consume the artificial sweetener equivalent of that, that's going to be for something like saccharin, a third of a pound of saccharin a year. And now I want to know, is a third of a pound of saccharin as bad as 100 pounds of sugar? And I find that very hard to believe.
Right.
The secondary question would be, is a third of a pound of saccharin worse or than no sweetener at all, which would be, in effect, water? And that's quite possible. So once we get rid of the sugar, it's quite possible that we respond to the artificial sweeteners in a way that is deleterious. Some of us, maybe not all of us, there's clearly individual variation. But that kind of research has never really been done. A lot of this research was never done in large part because we were just focused so much on this idea that saturated fat causes heart disease and that's where we should spend our research dollars. So, you know, for me, I think a lot of people need artificial sweeteners as crutches, in effect, as parachutes to use while they get off sugar. And in an ideal world, they would then get off the artificial sweeteners to lose their sweet tooth. You can think of the artificial sweeteners as the sweetener equivalent of nicotine gum for people who want to quit smoking. Some people, you know, if some people can clearly tolerate artificial sweeteners, we may find out that other people can't and that it triggers other issues or even, you know, sustains an obese or diabetic state. But again, that research just doesn't exist.
Right. I should say your book gives us the nice long view in a chapter called Big Sugar. We get a sense of the forces behind the sugar industry as such. Another chapter called Defending Sugar chronicles some of their relentless efforts to, in a sense, defend the good name of sugar against some of these criticisms. And you also certainly spell out some of what new science, better science, has told us about sugar. In our last minute or so, what is your advice for the average American, aside from reading your book, which is a great place to start, in terms of their own consumption of sugar?
Well, clearly I think the evidence against sugar is compelling. It's compelling enough that I don't consume it anymore, and I try to limit the sugar consumption of my children, which is always a struggle. And I think the best you can do is limit it. There's a lot of evidence arguing that sugar, again, is the primary cause of obesity and diabetes. And when we talk about, I use cigarettes as a metaphor, when we talk about cigarettes causing lung cancer, we don't say smoking too much causes lung cancer. We say smoking does, and then we advise people not to smoke. And part of the reason is because we also know that smoking is very addictive, and so you can tell people to cut back and have them moderate their cigarette consumption successfully. And if sugar causes obesity and diabetes, it's a very similar concept. And now you don't tell people that eating too much sugar causes obesity and diabetes because you don't know what too much is. And clearly sugar, while it may or may not be addictive, a lot of people act like it is. You know, I tell people, I think the single best thing you could do to live a healthier diet is to give up sugar, to avoid it.
Right.
Not try to eat it in moderation. Just say, I don't eat sugar anymore.
Mm. Well, people can certainly explore this topic further in your very thorough and fascinating book, which again is called The Case Against Sugar. It's published by Anchor Books, a division of Penguin Random House. The author, Gary Taubes. Gary Taubes, you've given me a lot to think about, and I think given our listeners a lot to think about as well. I appreciate this opportunity to speak with you about your very interesting book. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And it's 8:30, and you're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. Part two of the morning show is coming up next, a recent interview. And in part three, you'll hear an excerpt from one of my favorite interviews of 2017. Stay with us. I have been having lots and lots of fun with a delightful, crazy new book called This Book Isn't Safe, which is by Colin Furze. And I hope that you know the name Colin Furze from his exciting and sometimes sort of wacky presence on YouTube. He is known as the inventor of all kinds of absolutely crazy and wonderful devices. And he has become a YouTube sensation with over 5 million subscribers to his YouTube channel. A 5-time Guinness World Record holder, thanks to some of the inventions and innovations that he has created, like the do-it-yourself Wolverine claws or the alarm clock ejector bed, all kinds of wonderful things. And now there is a book in which you can get to know this inventor and be sort of taken behind the scenes of these wonderful YouTube videos that have taken the whole world by storm. The book is full of all kinds of illustrations and photographs that give the background on a number of his favorite inventions and spells out 10 crazy inventions that you or someone you love can create at home. The book, again, is called This Book Isn't Safe, and it's published by Razorbill, which is a division of Penguin Random House. And I'm excited to be able to spend the next few minutes talking with its author, Colin Furze. Colin Furze, we welcome you to the morning show.
How are we doing? Pleased to be here.
I'm glad to be talking with you. You are speaking to us from your home someplace north of London. Tell us a little bit about where you live.
A little place called Stamford. Population, I think, is about 20,000. I've not counted everybody personally, but I've been told it's roughly that. It's a small town. I mean, it's a typical British town. It's quite an old town, actually. The centre of it's all made of stone and everything, and we've got churches and bits and bobs. It's a very nice place to live.
Mm. And apparently a very nice place to do this crazy inventing. I have to ask you, what do the neighbours think of all this?
Their opinion of it goes up and down, depending on the size of the invention. Some of the bigger ones have not been too pleased with, and some of the noisier ones as well. But other than that, they're all fully supportive of it, really, and get quite interested in it, and sometimes even come up with ideas, which is quite funny, really, because you think they've come up with an idea, and I'm thinking, you do know I'm going to be building that like 6 foot away from your lounge. So, it's all good. It's all good.
And this is your hometown, if I remember correctly, from kind of the biographical information that's part of your delightful book. And you tell us that this interest in tinkering and building things has been a part of who you are from almost the very beginning.
Yeah, I mean, I'm as a child, I was a typical child. I used to like building and making stuff out of Lego and Meccano. And I used to live next door to a quarry, actually, or woods and a dump sort of thing. So you'd go up there, we could build dens and things like that. And, of course, after school, I went on to become a plumber, which is a very practical job. So all through my life, it's always been about, creating stuff, whether that be sticking bathroom suites in or building dens. And then, my extracurricular activity, what I used to do in my spare time, once I started filming it and putting it on YouTube, obviously got really successful. And that's kind of why it's gone in the direction it has. But yes, always been a practical person.
How many videos have you made for YouTube? I didn't take the time to literally or manually count them, but I was flabbergasted at how many videos I was paging past. Have you counted?
Yeah, I can tell you the exact number. It's 221, which is, in some terms, for a YouTube channel, that's not very many. But considering that most of them is things that I've made, then that is quite a lot.
What was the very, very first invention that you made for a YouTube video?
The first one which was properly constructed for something to go onto YouTube, I mean, we did this Wall of Death, which was a ring of pallets. I don't know if they call it a Wall of Death in the States, where you ride a motorcycle on the inside of a drum and you stick to the side. Now, I wouldn't class this as an invention as such, but it was a project which was built, the entire process of it was filmed and uploaded online. So that was kind of the first real project where I recorded the whole process, because I was doing this in my spare time as a bit of fun. You know, sometimes you'd only film, you know, the bit of it working or you know, the end bit, the results, so to speak. But I find my online audience, they like to see the build process, like to see how I got there. And by doing that, that's partly why I've been inspiring young kids and people to try and get into making things for myself, which is the main reason why I ended up doing this book. So that's kind of how it all links in, basically.
Right. Was it your idea or maybe one of your buddies who said, you know, you would be a natural to do this on a YouTube video and share this with the world? I mean, what prompted you to kind of take that leap to from just outside of your own little shed into this really public arena?
It came about of a few things, really, because I used to ride BMX bikes when I was a bit younger, and with that we used to film ourselves riding, and that's kind of where I developed like the video making skills, you know, how editing, putting it together, how to film stuff. So I already knew how to do that, and then in my spare time, you know, we started messing around. Some of it was making stuff, some of it was just doing prank sort of things, and I'd put all that on a VHS tape, and that used to get passed around the neighbourhood, And then somebody told me about YouTube, and I thought, oh, this is kind of just like a glorified version of my VHS tapes. I thought, you know, I've already got some video stuff. So I chopped little pieces out that was on that VHS tape and uploaded them as individual clips. And then I kind of got hooked on it then, really, because, I mean, I am a bit of a show-off, I suppose. I think anybody in the media has got to be, really, or else it wouldn't be for them. And seeing, you know, all these comments coming in, it was like kind of being able to visually see the reaction that I couldn't see when I passed the videotape around. I'd just get people coming up to me going, oh, we saw you, you know, saw that VHS tape, it was brilliant. So that, you know, and accompanied with, you know, being able to have the wider world been able to see it. And also, with the building aspect of things, I used to make things in my bedroom, but once my dad passed away, I could get in his shed because he didn't used to let me in his shed. So I don't know why. I'm quite a tidy person. And so all this happened that kind of like when YouTube first started in itself, me uploading, snipping these bits up, and then it kind of just took off, really. I could see that people liked seeing, you know, things being built, things working. And you kind of, I suppose you work to what your audience likes, really. And I like doing it. And, you know, so I just kept making more and more and more. And now it's become my job. So, which it's not really a job, is it? Because, I mean, everyone just thinks I sit at home all day and mess around. And I suppose in theory I do, really. I mean, making videos is quite hard work, but it's, you know, it is still messing around.
Mm-hmm. I like the spread in the book in which you pose the question and then answer, is being a YouTuber easy? And you kind of explain how it probably looks a lot easier than in fact it is, but in some ways it is also easy and tremendous fun. By the way, as you're answering this question, You explain that you are exceptionally popular in Germany, and explain to our listeners at least one reason why that might be.
One potential reason why the Germans find me fascinating is because Furz, if you say it as Furzer, it's fart. So of course, to a German person, I am Mr. Fart, you know, with the crazy inventions, and you can imagine as a child that's highly amusing. You know, who is this person, you know, constantly referred to as Colin Fart, you know, and he's got all these wacky inventions. So, you know, I every now and again, if I go over there, I will play on that fact because I suppose it makes people remember me a bit more. As a young child, I probably wouldn't have liked that too much. But, you know, at 38 years old, it doesn't really bother me now.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Colin Furz, and perhaps you know him from the hundreds of YouTube videos that he has created in which we watch him design and construct and then demonstrate for us all kinds of crazy inventions. And he has just created a new book, a delightful book called This Book Isn't Safe, in which he not only takes us behind the scenes of his crazy YouTube videos, but also spells out 10 crazy inventions that the reader can do at home. I'm wondering what sort of a leap that was in terms of trying to come up with inventions that would make sense for somebody at home to attempt, because that's kind of a different thing from the sort of wacky things that just spring out of your own imagination that you could build and safely build versus setting out possibilities for somebody at home, maybe without your experience or your skill set or whatever. Just tell us a little bit about how you thought about what these home inventions for the reader should be.
I kind of approached it from a few different angles, really. I tried to make sure that all the materials were accessible, because I thought there's no point in thinking of an invention that, you know, one of the components to it is really rare or difficult to get hold of or super expensive. So before I even started, you know, to think of stuff, you kind of thought of a load of bits of material which were very easy and cheap to get hold of. And then you kind of had to make sure that even if you didn't have a shed, you know, if you were somebody like me that had to make stuff in their bedroom or something like that, that some of them would still be possible, because not everyone has, you know, an amazing setup at home. If you live in a high-rise flat, for instance, you haven't even got a backyard to go and do stuff in. So I was thinking, is there anything that people could do in that sort of situation? So, you know, easy materials, materials you can get hold of, you know, accessible to everybody. Nice and cheap as well, because obviously not many people have got loads of money to throw at these things. And then just for them to build up in stages of difficulty. So you could do the first one pretty easily with barely any, you know, building ability or anything. And then each project would add a different skill, no matter how small it was. You know, it could be chopping wood, it could be putting screws into wood, tightening nuts up. But each project would escalate in an order. So, you know, you could do them all in order and build your confidence gradually. Because I think the main thing with people, you know, that want to get into creating stuff and building stuff is they can take on a too big a project straight away and then get a little bit disheartened, and then your confidence can take a knock. So it was making sure that everything kind of followed on from each other. And then by the time you've done all 10, you can look back and think, well, I've chopped metal, I've cut wood, I've screwed it, I've bolted it. You know, you could look at so many other things and think, well, I could make that now, because it's just, you know, a collaboration of all those skills.
Mm. And it sets them on a course to keep doing this on their own with their own innovations and ideas. I want you to spell out the very first of these 10, which in some respects is my favorite, the concrete crusher boots. but ahead of that, I want you to talk about words we see at the top of this very first page when we see these words: you might need to try this a couple of times to get it right. And I so appreciate that those words are there, because I think you're speaking to practicality and reality, and also the fact that probably a lot of youngsters and a few adults I know as well need to develop some resiliency, some persistence, to not just give up at the first failure or the first thing that doesn't go quite right. I suspect that's maybe kind of a hidden benefit to some of these projects.
Yeah. You know, anyone that expects to do something first time and it work, I mean, you can get lucky. It could do that. But a lot of things that I make need to be tweaked. Things need to be remade. And I think it's a skill in life that I think you need to, you know, that you need to reinforce to people, that failure is not a, you know, it's not a bad thing, sort of thing. That what's worse is not trying in the first place. And even if it does fail or something doesn't work, I mean, as many times we've all been creating stuff, the process of getting there has often thrown up something, or you've learned something along the way that you could put into something else, for instance. So, you know, you might make something that doesn't work, but halfway through it, you think, well, actually, if we chop it off and put this bit on there, it will do something else and create, you know, a different project. But you would have never have known that if you hadn't started. So, yeah, you know, I don't want people to try stuff, it not work, and then think, oh, you know, I'm useless, I can't do it. So, you know, those little words there are to just help people along. Because, you know, things I make don't always work.
You do also say that if it is a young reader who is attempting this, that adult supervision is a good idea. So tell our listeners about the concrete crusher boots, sort of what they look like, sort of how they get made.
Well, the concrete crusher, well, this is the first thing, the first project in the book. And I kind of thought, we've all got an old pair of wellies, and to mix up concrete, you know, you can go and buy a bag of ready-mixed mortar from your local hardware store. I mean, some of it is even already mixed up in the bag. You don't even have to have the sand and the cement mix. You just have to add water, mix it up. You basically kind of put your wellies in a bag.
And by the way, you need to translate that for these Midwestern Americans listening to you when you say wellies.
What would you call Wellington boots?
Well, just kind of, yeah, rubber boots of some kind, and maybe some of our more astute listeners know what those are, but right, so kind of rubber rain boots, I guess, would be a good way to
yeah,
think
yeah. It. The sort of footwear you'd put out if you went out in some deep puddles. Not waders, like fishing people, you know, they don't come up to your belly or anything like that, but yeah, those style of boots. And essentially, you put them in a bag. You support them off the ground a little bit, so you just put like a little cardboard rolls just underneath the soles, so the concrete or the cement, whatever you call it, can flow all the way around it. And then you basically shape them, so it still looks like a shoe. And then this is the bit where you can experiment as well, because you can add stuff to the cement if you want to try and make it a little bit stronger. This is to try and teach people, you know, kind of about fibers. You know, you could put staples, pins, you could put bits of string, bits of cotton. Just different ways of binding the cement together to make it stronger. Just, you know, it's just another one of those things to think about while you're making it. But I thought it's nice and easy. You've only got to mix some stuff up. You can get in a bit of a mess, leave it in the bag, let it set. Once it's set, take the bag off, stick the wellies back on, and then you can get some, you know, old toys. You can get, you know, cans and whatnot, and you can just stamp away and crush it. And even if you can't do that, because depending on how big you are, the wellies might be too heavy and you can't walk, then it just pins you to the ground. And that's quite funny as well. The next-door neighbour's kid that we tried it out, and he couldn't move anywhere with it, but he was laughing, absolutely laughing his head off. And his brother that had helped made it just thought it was brilliant that he pinned his brother to the floor using these shoes. So there's you know, it's just a lot of fun, basically. All the projects are just meant to be fun.
Absolutely. So things like the Mega Milk Bottle Raft or the Fab Frisbee Flinger, on and on. One thing I really appreciate, too, is that amidst all of the kind of wacky fun of this book, you don't neglect to, for instance, explain to a young reader how to saw wood, how to drill wood, how to measure, how to tighten nuts, how to screw a screw into wood. I suspect a lot of people putting a book together like this might not necessarily take the time to do that, but if you don't have those kind of skills, none of these crazy inventions can possibly get made.
No, I mean, this is the point of it, really. It starts right at the very beginning. So, you know, anybody out there that really, you know, is either not practical or wants to be practical, you know, you can't leave those things untold. I mean, it might for some people be really obvious, do you know what I mean, like where to drill, you know, to screw into wood, but a lot of people, they'll, you know, drill too close to the edge, they'll tighten things up, they'll split the wood. And even just sawing wood as well, you know, how to mark it and measure it. It for some people comes very naturally, but for others it doesn't. So you kind of, I've had to cover that to make sure that, you know, nobody feels left out, sort of thing. Because, you know, the whole point of this book in my eyes is to get people to make stuff, and they're more likely to make stuff if all the information's there and they actually achieve something. Because you've only got to make one thing and then you want to make something else. It's just getting, you know, getting people to complete one project, and then their confidence, hopefully, will do the rest for them.
If I remember correctly, you have at least one child. I think we see
I have two now.
Okay. So what do they make of this, and what kind of inspiration and or help are they to you?
Well, Jake, my son, he's the eldest, he's 5. My daughter, 1.5, she's too young to really to understand it all yet. And to be fair, Jake's starting to get to the grips with the fact that that more people, you know, everybody knows who I am in the town, because that's quite strange for a 5-year-old. But he's good. He's got his own little workbench in my shed. And he's starting to get a lot more into it, actually, and produce his own ideas as well. He's coming up to me, oh, Daddy, can you make this? Can we try and make that? And just getting him to hold screwdrivers and screws. You know, I've had him put in bits of screws in wood and stuff like that with a little cordless drill and stuff. So it's all going good. So, yeah, he's getting into it. I think in another couple of years, I should start getting worried. Then he'll be in there all the time making a mess and doing all sorts of things. But, you know, I encourage that. So
I'm sure you do. In the meantime, we encourage people to seek out this delightful book of yours called This Book Isn't Safe. It's published by Razorbill, a division of Penguin Random House, and the author, Colin Furze. And, of course, you can also check out Colin Furze on YouTube, where you will find literally hundreds of videos that he has created showing him building and demonstrating his incredible inventions. Colin Furze, this has been really fun to speak with you, and very best wishes to you with all of the inventing yet to come.
Thank you very much. Much appreciated.
And the time is 8:50 here on WGTD. And to finish out today's program, I want to replay for you one of my very, very favorite interviews from 2017. This is an interview that I recorded back in late February, and it was with novelist Christina Baker Klein, talking about one of the best novels I think I have ever read, called A Piece of the World, inspired by one of the most intriguing paintings of the 20th century called Christina's World by Andrew Wyeth. And in this famous painting, we see in the foreground a woman sitting in the grass as though sort of crawling on her hands and knees, and we see a house in the distance. And this was actually a painting of a woman that painter Andrew Wyeth actually knew, Christina Olsen. And the novel, which Christina Baker Klein has written about this woman, imagining more about her life, is called Christina's World. And it is an absolutely beautiful novel. And I so appreciated the opportunity to speak with Christina Baker Klein about it. Here is that brief conversation. One of the most beautiful lines from your novel, I think, is towards the very, very beginning when your central character, Christina, is visited by Betsy and asking how things are going with her brother. The same is good, yes, when she says the same. And Christina says, I smile, sure, the same is good. And, of course, that's so much about her, in a sense, limited, constricted world. Talk for a moment about the care you took in trying to describe such a life and such a person in authentic terms without, in a sense, being too bleak?
Gosh, that is a perfect question, because that became my obsession as the author of this book. I wanted to do justice to the real life story of Andrew Wyeth and his relationship with Christina Olsen, the subject of this painting, Christina's World. So my novel, A Piece of the World, explores that relationship. In doing so, it also delves deeply into her life, as you've just described it. I wanted the reader to understand her, to not identify with her necessarily, because I think not many people will identify with her. She lived on a remote point on the coast of Maine. She had to take care of her family. She had to drop out of school at the age of 12 to do that. Her father made her... she was very smart, but he made her drop out of school so that she could help run the farm. And her life was kind of quiet and a little bit bleak, I would say. She had a degenerative illness until Andrew Wyeth came into it, and he transformed her life. And he had a beautiful relationship, an incredible friendship. And he respected her and liked her, and they talked and talked for hours. And the line you just read, the same, you know, sure, the same is good. But Christina Olsen wanted more out of life, and Andrew Wyeth brought her more. And that was the joy of telling this book, telling this story.
Right. I think one thing that's quite intriguing is that here she is living a very limited, constricted life, at least geographically.
Yeah.
I mean, hardly ever straying from the farm. And you have at one point, Christina, thinking to herself, when your world is small, you learn every inch of it. And yet, in some ways, she didn't know every inch of her world until this artist, Andy Wyeth, enters her life, because he enters her world, this small little farmhouse, and notices things that she and her brother Al have not noticed. I mean, talk for a moment about the artist's eyes and what a difference that makes.
Absolutely right. And later in the book, there's a line where she says, "He makes me see things anew." You know, Andrew Wyeth comes and he focuses on things in the house, a cracked teapot and the mantelpiece with shells on it and a blue door scratched by the dog. And I look at those things through his eyes and I see them differently. By the way, I'm traveling around the country doing this big book tour, and I get really bored at reading, so I'm not reading much. I might read one page or something, but I have a slideshow. And in the slideshow, I show you a photograph of a piece of the house or something in Christine Olsen's world, and then I show you Andrew Wyeth's painting of it, and you can see both how similar it is and how different his representation. And that was, I looked at those photographs and then at his paintings over and over again. That was what I was trying to capture in the novel, is a sense that he brought this sensibility, this artist's sensibility, to her experience that made her look at it in a different way. And I think we can all agree that perspective shapes everything. That you, if you have, depending on your perspective, you can see an event as positive or negative. And I think that for Christina, Wyeth did exactly that. He provided a portal for her to see her own world in a new way.
She, as someone who comes from hardy stock, as it's described at one point, and of course she lives, in a sense, the tamest of lives, but comes from this intriguing family. Just say a very brief word about her hardy stock.
So her hardy stock was part of the great joy for me of researching this book, discovering that Christina Olsen, this quiet woman on the coast of Maine, was descended from the presiding judge of the Salem witch trials. His name was John Hathorne. He was the only magistrate who did not recant. He went to his deathbed saying that he was glad that he had put 24 witches to death. And he was just a brutal man in general. He persecuted Quakers and killed Native Americans and bad guy. So his family was tainted by association, you know, with him over the decades after he died. And three young men, Hathorne men, changed the spelling of their name and fled to the coast of Maine, built three log cabins in the middle of winter, one of which eventually ended up becoming the house in the painting, Christina's World. Another relative of Christina's was Nathaniel Hawthorne, who changed the spelling of his name, also left Salem, and ended up writing about people like his great uncle, who had persecuted others without looking at the sin in his own life. Mm. And that's what Nathaniel Hawthorne focused on. So those kinds of details about Christina Olsen's real history were fascinating to me, and I focused on them and I wove them through the book as well.
Right. And of course, she is someone who has demonstrated great courage in the face of her own physical debilitation and just contending with all the frustrations of life. You also tell us that in many respects, Christina and this talented painter, Andrew Wyeth, are both misfits, and that might be a key to why there is such a powerful connection between them.
Yeah, absolutely. They were both misfits, and yet on the surface, Andrew Wyeth seemed so perfect. He was, by all accounts, movie star handsome. He was raised in a wealthy family. He grew up in a mansion. They had multiple cars. His father was a famous artist. Andrew Wyeth became a famous artist at a very, very young age. By the age of 20, he'd been featured on the cover of a famous art magazine and had won awards. So they seem really different. But in fact, he identified with Christina. He considered himself, as you said, a misfit, sort of an oddball. He walked with a limp because he'd had a childhood disease as well. He had discomfort in the same, physical discomfort in the same way that Christina Olsen did. She had a degenerative disease. But he also related to her because he was an introvert and because he liked to be alone and because he was stubborn and, as he said, pigheaded. And so he spent hours and hours talking with her, and they had developed quite a bond.
Well, that is just one source of great beauty in your moving, poignant novel called A Piece of the World, published by William Morrow. Christina Baker Klein, congratulations on a masterpiece.
Thank you so much for that, and thank you for having me.
Again, that was novelist Christina